A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hello, my lovely podcast listener. How are you today? You find me upstairs in Mickey's room, which is also my wardrobe room. I did manage to get this place quite organised for a while, but now it's looking like it needs a bit of TLC. I've been working quite a lot recently. And actually, this is my first weekend off in 8 weekends, I think, 9 weekends. Lots of festivals, lots of gigs. So it's been really nice just not going out and just taking some time with the family and just, yeah, not living out of a bag for a weekend. The festivals have been amazing. I've had some awesome gigs, but I am quite happy just to be sat at home and not doing so much. And that's probably why I sound quite so lethargic. I think I'm actually fairly knackered. There's been a lot of 7-day weeks going on around here. And I think also we're kind of heading towards half term, so the kids are a bit knackered too. In fact, my youngest, Mickey, is not very well today, which is a shame. There's so many bugs going around, aren't there, now that we're all out and about and meeting each other again. All those other things that were being repressed are now out and about. And, yeah, I've got quite a busy week ahead, but I've done the majority of my stuff for the book now, the promotion of that, so that's out in the world. And thank you so much for all the response that I've been having. If you're one of the people that has got in touch about the book, then honestly, it meant a lot to me. It's been a slightly, well, what's the right word? I suppose it's just, it's made me feel a bit more vulnerable than the usual release. When you put an album out into the world, albums are laced with lots of stuff. They're incredibly collaborative. And even though there might be lots of your own emotions in there that are completely authentic to what you're living through, you can mask it in amongst other things and other characters. Whereas in the book, if it's an autobiography, there's not really those layers, you know. A bit weird if I wrote a whole chapter where I was talking about how I felt about something, but I did it as if I was a witch living in a house on top of the hill. Like Love is a Camera, for example. I don't know if that reference quite made sense to you, but I knew what I meant. And this week, your lovely guest for the podcast is someone that I first read about at the BBC website. And there was an article about this lady, and I just thought, whoa, what a different life she's been living. So her name is Pallavi. She lives in Delhi with her little boy, who is 8 years old. She went through, grew up in a very traditional Indian family, although there were kind of, I don't know, sort of whispers and talking, you know, in hushed tones around her family, because the fact emerged that her mother had had an affair. So that was the sort of backdrop to her upbringing, where she'd be asked questions. There was a lot of intrigue about her mum and about this adventure she'd had with another man. And Pallavi herself went into an arranged marriage and was not very happy with and that there wasn't really any love there, and came out the other side and had a lot of her own experiences as a single woman dating people. I mean, she did have a little boy by then, but she was, you know, leading quite an active dating life, and would talk to her friends about all the men she was meeting and the dynamic of those relationships and sexual encounters. And people started to come to her for advice because actually she found it was a very repressed society. And generally speaking, people weren't being very open about sex. Now, here in the UK, growing up in the UK, I'd say by and large, we're not as repressed as all that, insofar as, you know, you don't have to look very far to, if you started a conversation with a friend about the sex life, that's not an unusual thing that you could chat to someone about that if you wanted to. However, in my own life, I'm not sure that I am quite that open, really. So even though Pallavi has led a very different life growing up in India and now primarily speaking to other Indian men and women about how to help them be their full 360 sexual selves, I'm not sure that I feel like I'm a million miles away from that, insofar as I think I was always quite prudish, really, and I'm getting better articulating those things as I've got older. So it came to me through adulthood, really, rather than the culture I was growing up in. Anyway, there's lots of things that will make you think about how she speaks and what the work she's been doing and also the turnaround in her life. So over to Pallavi and our chat, which we did remotely because she was, it was nighttime in Delhi when we spoke. And I will see you on the other side. Thank you very much for giving me your time today. I first read about you on the BBC website, and I thought your story really stood out because, firstly, I think, you know, being a sex therapist is something, and a couples therapist is something that is, you know, not everybody ends up in that line of work, but I think it's such a valuable and important part of our culture that people can talk about these things and know where to go for advice. Because otherwise all these things get so pushed down. But also because you were talking about growing up in a culture where traditionally women, particularly, their sexuality and sexual needs and desires are incredibly repressed. Because you have a little boy, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so is he about 8? Is that?
He's 9.
He's 9, okay, yeah. I've got a 9-year-old as well. And so were you in this line of work when you had your baby?
No, so I'm a sexuality coach. I'm not a therapist.
Okay.
When he was born, I was like the typical, typical conservative woman with the limited understanding of life. Like, okay, I mean, I would say have a family. Growth was something that never crossed my mind. For me, growth was something that I just counted in the money. Like, okay, how much raise I'm going to have each year is how I measured my growth, not as a person, not as a woman. You know, it was never about my individuality. So, to talk about my journey, how I became a sex educator or a coach, it is definitely a mix of life experiences. As I came from a dysfunctional family, and both my parents had affairs, okay? But my mother's affair was something that did not go well because she was the dependent. She was financially dependent. So even though both the people had their own share of mistakes, it was my mother who ended up paying it for more because she was a dependent woman in a patriarchal society. At the same time, as a kid, I was sensitized to relationships which did not just follow the norm. Like, you know, the conventional heterosexual monogamous marriage. But I also saw other relationships at a very tender age. And that also kind of helped me open up and be sensitive to and not be judgmental, because I also saw this happening in my very own family. But then I was like very determined that, you know, I'm not going to repeat this in my life. My family would be something. I will be having a stable family. I was so, so determined about it. But at the same time, what I now understand is that it's not just you and your husband, it's also the culture around you that shapes the family. So the culture around me was very restrictive, be it sexually restrictive, like, you know, right from the day one. Like, I was in a relationship before I got married, which was also, I was sexually active in that relationship. It was a committed relationship. So I would not go into the judgment that had it been casual, would it be still okay? But let's say that the social norm is that, you know, you need to be sexual with someone you are committed. So I was committed in every sense, but the relationship could not work well. The boy broke up. And even though I had all the right reasons to say that, you know, I did not do anything wrong because mm-hmm. I was committed and I was looking for a life together. I was looking to get married by the social standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Yet my parents said that, okay, now that we are going to arrange a marriage for you, you need to be quiet about it, that, you know, you had a relationship and it was a sexual relationship. Because in India, and this is, I'm saying in India, in the context of arranged marriages, which is marriages arranged by families, you cannot actually say that you are sexually experienced or you are sexually active. You yeah. need to pretend that if you are not, you need to pretend that you are a virgin. This is for majority of, like, maybe there could be some rare cases. We are not, I'm not talking about outliers. I'm talking about predominant, you know, the behavior. So I was also told that, okay, I need to be, I need to pretend that I'm a virgin. I pretended to be a virgin. On the eve of wedding night, it was again, I thought like, and I still get these stories from women even now when they say, ma'am, what will happen if our husbands would get to know that we are not virgin? And I tell them that, you know, there is no way he can figure that out.
Yes. Stage one, they can't figure it out, true. But also, I suppose there's that trepidation and that way that it made you feel. And also, forgive my clumsiness with my language. So you've called yourself a coach rather than a therapist. What is the difference? Because I'm obviously a bit daft there. What's the differentiation?
The differentiation between coach and a therapist?
Yes.
So I'm not a medical professional, as in I cannot prescribe medicine. That's one.
Okay.
The second is my scope of work is more around education.
Okay.
It is more about, in our society, there is a lack of like basic sex education, that they don't know about their bodies. They don't know about communication. There is so much of challenge and block talking to each other.
Yeah.
So it's more on the education side. I can say it's an education. I'm an educationist.
Okay. So do you actually work within schools?
No, I don't work with schools. It's mostly the adults. And I'm certified as an educator and a NLP practitioner and a couple of other certifications that I have. So I work as a coach, like coaching people. Like, you know, I would say it's like from a wellness point of view. It's not something is wrong with you, but it is something that you want to enhance and you want to have a coach.
Got it. So sometimes with this education, presumably, it's also teaching people how to, what information they pass on to their kids and to the next generation. Because presumably that's still a big part of how you're helping people, you know, make the next generation feel a lot more comfortable and empowered. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and are you seeing things change with things, do you think? I mean, I suppose it's, you know, we're talking about a big culture here where, that, as you say, you've got it patriarchal. You know, this is not something that can be moved on overnight. But being somewhere like Delhi where it's, you know, is it progressing?
See, it is changing. I would definitely not say it is progressing because, again, there is this new wave of sexual liberation that has kind of, you know, that has kind of engulfed our country all over, like right from the LGBTQIA+ movement, where people are coming out and people are talking about bisexuality and same-sex relationships. You know, that's actually has grown up over the years, and extramarital relationships, divorces, all of this is happening in my country. But at the same time, if I talk about the young people, there is this, I would say, fad. It's like a fad, which is like a trend of hookups and casual sex,
mm-hmm.
which is, it is also somewhere to look cool. Because there was a time when I was not a sex educator. 5-6 years down the line,
mm-hmm.
before I became a sex educator, and I was talking to a friend and he said, okay, I have slept with 65 women, or I have slept with 100 women, or I have mm-hmm. slept with 35. So it's like keeping the score. Mm. I've actually seen a lot of people still, they talk about the number of sexual partners, and I say, hey, you being, your sexual prowess doesn't depend on number of people you sleep with.
Yep. Yeah, that's very true. And actually, I think that's something that's maybe still evolving with how people think of themselves, actually. You know, because I think, especially when you're young, it's all about that idea of, you know, I mean, what, notches on a bedpost, you know, that's where that kind of idea comes from, that, that yeah, the more people you've had, you know, sex with or been with intimately, the more you're progressing.
Yeah, yes. I mean, it was like there was actually a pressure because you know, I've been through these circles also. Like, my journey is not just formed by the books I read or the courses I attended, but it's actually through my life. I have met people at different stages. There was a time when I absolutely was against marriage. Like, you know, I mean, if I go back and read my 3 or 4 years post, I was I was actually rebelling because I had been through a failed marriage and I've seen extramarital affairs, and I was like questioning the sanctity of marriage, and I said, okay, there is no marriage. And then I came in touch with a group of people who said that, okay, you know, you can have 5 or 6 partners and you can have individual relationship with those partners. And for me, I said, okay, that's good, because at least it will not get me to do the deeper work. You know, mm-hmm. I can be superficially connected to 5 or 6 people, and it's keeping this in a limitation, like, okay, it's more of a sexual and acquaintance kind of a relationship, but not really. I felt that 1-to-1 is too much of a hard work. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm incapable of that. And somewhere I started believing. So it was, you know, it was not just my own belief, but also an external influence, which is what I'm really worried about when I see this new culture unfolding, is that because we don't have sex ed, because when we don't have conversations, empowered, informed conversations around sex, we end up relying a lot on our peer group who is as uninformed, who is just as influenced. Yeah. And we think that, okay, this is something, if my peer group is like having hookups and casual sex or this, let me just go with the flow.
Of course, yeah, and absolutely. And I suppose it's peer groups and also the internet, because is it still the case that India is one of the, it's like one of the main places for things like Pornhub and for people watching that? Is that right? Is that still the case?
Yes, we are the world's third. I think the last report I saw, it was a third ranked country in the terms of viewership on Pornhub.
Yeah, because I guess, what's sex education like now in India? Is it starting to be something that's coming in, or
for I can tell you, thanks to social platforms, where Instagram especially, you know, a lot of people have come up. Not a lot of people. See, we are a country of 1 billion population. I can actually count on my fingers the number of educators we have. With the sexologist, we did have sexologists, but it's more of a medical view of, you know, there is vaginismus or... But the talk about pleasure is so intimidating.
Yeah, pleasure, like, that's the thing, isn't it?
I can still talk about health, I can still talk about menstruation, I can still talk about safe sex, but can I talk about fantasies? Or can I talk about how I love to masturbate, or what is the way I masturbate? Like, you know, masturbation is something where you don't go on a level of personalization. Like, okay, individual can have, like, I just once posted... And sometimes I know I'm revealing a lot about my personal life, because I feel we need to have role models where people know that masturbation doesn't mean that, you know, the kind of images that see in porn, they think that masturbation is vigorous shaking of the penis. Like, it's like vigorous, like, you know, you actually, something is kind of, and that's, and I say, okay, masturbation could be just touching yourself while you're reading a book. Okay, you're reading a book and you felt like just touching, which is you're just keeping your hand on your external labia and just might be just flicking your fingers around, like just like fingertips, just touching the labia with your fingertips, and you're reading the book, or you might be on a call. And I wrote this, that you might be on a call and you might be touching. And then they say that, okay, this is very, very, I would say, disrespecting to the other person on the call. And I said, I didn't go there. I mean, I can touch my body and it might not have to do with the other person. So they actually felt that I'm trying to get some sense, stimulation, but it can go so haywire. My idea was to, you can masturbate even while you do things, like, you know, you're just thinking about something or you're just in stress. So just to normalize masturbation.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think, I mean, listening to you speak, I was thinking that actually being able to be open about that thing you said, pleasure, and pleasure when it comes to your sexual self, is something that a lot of adults don't necessarily get to that. It's not sort of regarded as part of our development, if you know what I mean, that that's an important, you know, we're encouraged, but to actually speak about it. And even in my own upbringing and talk at school and all of that, I don't think that was massively part of my generation's emphasis when it came to sex either. In fact, I think a lot of it was about how the other person would feel when you were having sex, and if you were seeming like you knew what you were doing, and if you were experienced and all this kind of thing. So there's sort of almost three sort of sides to it, really. I suppose from your first experiences with your arranged marriage and being encouraged to keep very quiet about the world, you know, the life you'd led before it, and then feeling empowered enough and mature enough to be able to acknowledge how you were actually feeling, what was important. But then making it part of how you actually, you know, spend your days and your job, that's something that's, you know, are you kind of amazed, really, in a way that that's now something that you're, if you look back on how you were then, it's now, because it's still quite recent, I guess, if your little boy's only 9, you know, it's still quite relatively recent history, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Yeah, exactly.
And how long have you been a sex educator now?
I started in 2017, and I would literally say I came out in 2018.
What do you mean?
So I was this anonymous blogger.
Okay.
I created a page where I didn't even put my surname because I was in a job and I didn't want people to find me, and I was just pouring my heart out. So it was only my first name followed by the abbreviated surname like Pallavi B. Mm-hmm. So I use the B so that no one can actually find out.
Yeah.
And it took me 1 year because I knew that if my office is going to discover that, you know, I'm talking about sexuality and I was in a day job, either there would be a lot of gossip mongering behind my back, you know, and which I was not ready to, I was not comfortable, me being the fodder of gossip, which I was very sure that there will be gossiping, or either I will be fired. So I knew that there would be very, but then over a period of time, I gained courage that, okay, now I think I will be able to stand on my feet. I have enough savings. And then I decided to came out. It was my coming out journey.
So how did you do that? You actually sort of decided to set up a website with your name attached, or set up a business? What was the coming out? How did that manifest?
So I was anyways thinking of leaving the job, but I got fired. So it was actually preponed 6 months before. And then I said, okay, now that I'm fired, I'm not going to go back and do that job. I'm going to give some time to really see if I can work it out. Mm-hmm. And I think I just created a page on Facebook because it's like 4 years back, Instagram was not that popular.
Mm-hmm.
So I created a page on Facebook and I started writing vigorously. So I know that I had a lot of material from my own personal life, which feel like, you know, I had got a lot of stock of stories.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, let me first start. And then I started getting stories of people, like they started talking about me as if I'm a therapist or I'm a doctor, and I say, okay, why they are reaching out? I can't help them, I'm just a writer. But they reached out to me because they knew, they always say that, you know, thank you, there is someone who can who we can confide and who will not judge us.
Exactly.
Because they thought I'm talking about my sex life, so I will not judge their sex life. So and that made me think that, okay, this is some way more than I've imagined. The problem is way more. The issues are way more. And there is no one. And I had all the inspiration to really think of it as a career.
Yeah. But like they probably think, yeah, not only because you're very honest, so they can talk to you because, as you say, you won't be judgmental. But also you've been on both sides of the tracks as well. You know, you've been that person that felt like that side of yourself was just not even acknowledged, and in fact quite shameful actually. So the fact that you've experienced all of that, so I think sometimes we think of people who work in that field as being people who've always been incredibly confident about talking openly about those things, and maybe grew up in a household where it was quite, you know, comfortable with that. So actually, to the fact you've been through all the spectrum is quite amazing. Have you had some good conversations with your family since this?
I tell you, that's again, so thankfully my family was not resistant in the sense they did not kind of threaten me that, okay, because there are so many families, a lot of people have those families.
Yes,
but I would not say they are supportive. We follow a don't ask, don't tell policy.
Yeah.
So, you know, they won't ask any questions. I won't give any answers. But now it's somewhere because of these features, global features or national features, I've started sending them links and they read it and they feel, okay, their daughter is somewhere featured, which means she's doing something which is like, you know, right, even though she talks about sex. And I actually, you know, I'm amused when my mother, so just yesterday she was talking to someone and the other person asked, what does your daughter do? And she said, she is a sex educator. And that I saw my mother utter this word, like, sex, it's such a big thing for me.
So that was only yesterday?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, but I guess things like, you know, the fact that it reached me all the way here on the BBC website, and I know you've also given a TED talk, and I think these things are, you know, that's like a real stamp of credibility and a proper platform.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit a million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.
What was the significance for you of doing the TED Talk, do you think?
I think when I was approached for a TED Talk, I had like ideas like, what do I present? And I knew that since this is a public platform and there will be people who will be seeing me, I wanted to come out very raw. Like as you said, that, you know, I've seen that entire spectrum. So I said, okay, I'm going to talk about my knowledge and wisdom, but I'm also going to talk about how I acquired it. What was the journey behind it?
Yeah.
So I remember, you know, there's this line where I actually said that I gave oral sex to my partners, S in plural, but I never received one from them. Like, that was my story about my own inhibitions about receiving oral sex as a guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
Like, it is something I feel guilty about it because the other person is doing me a favor. Though when I do it to him, he deserves it, but I don't deserve it. I mean, that inhibition was there in my mind for such a long period of time. So I talked about this on stage and I was like, oh my God, I'm talking about my story of oral sex on a public stage. And I thought, okay, people are going to throw stones at me after I come out. I was like ready for a backlash, but they were so supportive. Like, I think everyone said that this is very unique and unconventional. And I know what I'm doing is something. I'm not encouraging people to, you know, talk about their sex lives on a public platform. At the same time, I know it's absolutely crucial for few of us to do so that millions could have their sex life sorted in the bedroom. It is absolutely a need of the hour for at least some people to come up and talk about, yeah, you know, what a real sex life is. What is a negotiation? You can mug up as much theory as possible, but when you are in bedroom with that man or a woman, the concept of real negotiation and, you know, your theory is just going to be there out of the door. Yeah. Unless you have not practiced it.
Yeah. No, I think you really hit the nail on the head as well, where you said, you know, the fact that you're doing that will actually help millions of people, because that's how it trickles through. And just normalizing even that idea of, you know, oh, I always felt like they were doing me a favor. You know, it's like, I think that probably these are things that are so entrenched in a lot of us, particularly when you're on the female side of things in a straight relationship, because when you're young, you know, it's still not until, I think it's still evolving, that women are allowed to be seen as equal in terms of setting the tone of what's happening, the parameters of what feels okay. You know, we've got so many conversations going on all the time, haven't we, about consent, and we're looking left and right. We're looking at our young boys and talking to them about that side of things and how we can help them actually understand. I think I saw something on your Instagram where you said, saying yes or no, that we have that as the bar of what is the acceptance of consent. Yeah. It's such a low bar. I thought that was such a brilliant perception, because yes, there's lots of ways to have a conversation where you can sense that the, you know, someone's not comfortable, even if they haven't actually said no. I think in a way, I mean, that's probably like, we're still getting the no thing established, aren't we? But all this stuff, it's still getting out there. And I suppose so much of it is just so recent, you know, we're not that far away from, you know, Victorian England, where it was a very different level of expectation and depravity, because it was also so pushed behind doors, really. Yeah. So your upbringing, where did you grow up, Pallavi?
So I grew up in a small city. Again, it was a patriarchal in the sense, not thankfully, you know, my parents were always forthcoming about education, but they had this clear role defined that you need to get married and you need to have your own home, and sexuality was no, like you can't talk about sex. And even while I was married, I think I also internalized that, okay, sex is something which is not for me, you know, maybe it is something which is more for him.
Yeah. And yeah. Are you part of a big family?
Yeah, yes. I have a joint family.
And where are you in the pecking order? Where are you in the lineup? Are you near the bottom or near the top with your siblings?
So, we are a ton of siblings. And I would like to mention here that, you know, my extended family doesn't talk to me. They don't talk to me because, again, I've chosen this line of work. They don't let their kids talk to me because they think I will be a bad influence. And some of their kids do talk to me.
I was going to say, I bet they want to talk to you. Yes. And that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. And the kids do come and kids do talk to me. And one of the kids is bisexual. And, the person, he found support. And he said, okay, I'm glad that there is someone in my family. But, you know, it's such a discreet thing that I can't reveal the gender. I can't reveal, of course. But again, that's like the when the topic of sex comes in, like, you know, there is this, I was outcasted from my own family.
Yeah.
My parents are there with me. My parents talk to me, but none of my extended relatives, none of them talk to me.
Yeah, that's
the level
tough.
Of judgment. Yeah.
Yeah, judgment. And I think as well, there's this weird thing, isn't it, that if conversations are had, it's going to sort of introduce ideas to people that they didn't have, that it's something, you know, it's going to unleash this side of them. Whereas actually, all you're really doing is allowing people to not feel ashamed of that side of themselves and lead a happier, more fulfilled life. But I think there's lots of ways that fear can show itself, particularly when it comes to, you know, particularly if you're part of a generation that wasn't given that, and you end up thinking, well, I've lived my life without prioritizing that and everything's been fine for me. And the idea that someone else might have an experience that's somehow a little more open, a little more relaxed, that also throws into sharp relief your own choices you've made. Because actually there's a lot of bravery in going from, you know, that traditional upbringing to where you are now.
Yes, I would like to mention this incident. And maybe a handful of instances. Like, I was doing this talk with Suchandra Das, who is she's a lesbian and she has married her female partner. And she was talking about something which is called as corrective rape. And I was like, what is that? Corrective rape. And she said that if a girl is lesbian, so what? Some families, they think that if they get her to have sex with a man, she will get a taste of what intercourse is. And she can, then she might turn into a heterosexual. So not everyone, of course, a lot of families do support. So I'm not saying this is a generalization, but even if it is happening with one girl in the country,
yeah.
I mean, imagine the atrocity. And most of these people who commit corrective rape are her from own family, her own uncles or maybe cousin brothers.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Oh, that's horrific.
That's horrific.
And corrective rape is just the most horrendous terminology as well.
Yes.
There's been all sorts of atrocities done over the years for sort of trying to, make someone who is gay, lesbian, turn somewhere else. It's just a horrendous idea. And I hadn't heard of that before. That's deeply traumatic as an idea.
Yes, yes, yes. I had like goosebumps because even I hadn't heard, like even being in India, this was something she was telling it to me. And I was horrified. I said, okay, even if it is one girl or three girl, it's still something that really needs to be corrected, like needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
No matter if it is just a handful of girls, they don't deserve this.
Yeah.
But it's all about the ignorance and the stigma around sex. Like, okay, sex.
Yeah, I know. When you talked about the stigma around sex, I mean, how much do you think, I suppose it sounds like the seeds were sown very early on about this sort of the way people would speak about your parents' marriage all throughout your childhood, this mystery around your mother's sort of secret life. Is that right? Because I think when I was reading the article, it said that she had had an affair very early on in her relationship with your dad. But
yeah.
Then it had just been sort of this mystery, and people would sometimes ask you questions about it when you were little.
Yes.
Yeah, that must have been very, I suppose that set the scene, didn't it? For like, what is the mystery here? What is behind that door?
Yeah, I mean, I have even known on some level, I know that every person do have these desires and fantasies for themselves. Mm. There is no person who would say I'm desexualized. But when it comes to on a social level, on a cultural level, we like to show ourselves as desexualized beings. We like to disown our sexuality on a social level. So I tell you, when I was 18 and my brother was newly married, it was like just 3 months in marriage and I went to visit his home. He was my cousin brother. And this, my sister-in-law, she was this newly married and very young and beautiful. And she said, okay, let's sleep together and we will just look through the family album of the wedding album. So we had this wedding album and we would just look and scroll through the pictures. And then my brother, elder brother, he was like, no, she can't sleep with you in your room. I want her in her room, which is now I understand that he wanted to have sex with her that night. He was utterly impatient, though even I was there just for a day.
Yeah.
I left the next day. So that in essence means that, okay, you as much like sex as I do. The only difference is I'm talking about it. How it makes such a big difference between you and me,
mm-hmm.
when I just chose to talk about it, whereas you are equally sexual. You are equally liking sex with your wife so much that you couldn't let her go for a day with me. So, you know, our culture is obsessed with sex on some level, at level, and we are as much repulsed by it. It's a very strange conflict that we are as much repulsed by it as much we are obsessed about it.
Yeah, yeah. But actually, when you're repulsed by something, but also, as you say, obsessed by it, that also is internal about yourself, about how you feel about your own, what brings you pleasure. That becomes repulsive to you as well. And that's a really hard way to live your life if it's also something that's a big part of your life. I suppose you must have heard as well some incredible stories from people that come to see you who maybe are only, you know, decades and decades into their adulthood and they're only just now thinking, actually, I want to find that happiness.
Yes, I get a lot of stories on sexless marriages and I feel that, okay, I understand how it feels to be. Like, there's this man who is 39 and he is the senior vice president of a, like, you know, very unicorn e-commerce organization. And he says, Pallavi, I'm fit. I'm good looking. I've really worked out on myself. I am successful. But this is for what? Like, this is for buying groceries? I don't have a sexual relationship with my wife. What I'm doing, I'm just managing the chores.
Yeah.
But what is more than that? So definitely sex is something which is taking your life from ordinary to extraordinary at some level, and then you are denied that ordinariness and you feel like life is all about a set of chores.
Yeah.
And sex is a space where you feel alive, you feel rejuvenated, you feel pleasure, and all of this is taken away from you. As a human being, you are a sexual being. We are all sexual beings. Like, of course, I understand asexuals, like, say, but not everyone is an asexual. But we are sexual beings, but we are denied our sexuality. And then we have to live with that, because if I go out and I talk about that my wife is not giving sex to me, my character will be murdered. My character will be tarnished. I will be a debacle.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when I'm just trying to get the chronology a little bit. So you obviously had a moment where, what was the job that you were doing before all this started? Was it and nothing to do with what you're doing now, I imagine?
So I was a product manager. So I was into product development of IT startup.
Okay. And this is what you were doing after you've had your baby?
Yes. Till the time I quit that job.
Okay. So do you think when you look back, because I know that I read that when you were 32, you found yourself the other side of your marriage and a single mum. Do you think some of that sort of empowered you? Do you think that becoming a mother played a part in you helping you sort of, you know, come out of that repressed side of your life?
I think certainly, this will not be true for every woman. So I would not say motherhood helped me out. But as a mother, you know, I have experienced a very different shade of my sexuality, which is responsible sexuality, which is very emotional sexuality, very sensitive sexuality, because I already had that part of me because I had a baby. So, you know, to say that if I might be a single woman, it would have been very different for me than when I was a mother also.
Yeah.
And also that the sexuality of a mother is quite interesting. Like, as a mother, you know, where you have to tend to your baby in the day and you can be ferocious at the night. And this is just a different shade of you, you know, as a person. So which was very novel for me to discover that there could be two different shades. One could be just so, you know, homely and so affectionate, and something where I can be really asserting my own individuality as a woman. Because, you know, a lot of times when we get into that role of a mother, then it's so difficult to see the woman inside you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you put that so well. You're very, very good at articulating these emotions that happen. And actually, as you say, that sort of spectrum of yourself where you've got the side of you that is the mother. And I totally agree with you, by the way, that motherhood doesn't always play the part, you know, in it doesn't always empower, it doesn't always change your life in that way. And I, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people now, where that's why it's a curious subject to me, really, because it's such a broad range of ways it can change your life. Sometimes huge. Some people, actually, they just sort of continue on the same trajectory they're already on, and the baby just kind of strap on their back and keep going. But for other people, it is a big life change. And I think particularly when it comes to, as you say, your sexual side, the idea of this sensitive, nurturing thing by day, and then still have the other side of you, and acknowledging both, and allowing yourself both. I think, I know some women hugely struggle, even in pregnancy, that the idea that they can be a sexual person and pregnant is something that they really find, you know, just not that instinctive, I guess. Maybe that's another, I don't know if taboo is quite the word, but it's definitely something that's not really spoken about that much, really, about how that makes you feel and how you feel about your body. It's such a complicated relationship, maybe as well. It's quite hard to work it out sometimes when you're in the middle of it.
Right, yeah.
And now that you have your little boy, I suppose I'm the mother of sons. So I have five sons, and my middle boy is the same age as yours. And it's really made me think as well about how I raise them to be sensitive, responsible, sexual adults one day. Because I'm not actually squeamish about the idea of them when they're older having a sex life. That doesn't freak me out, you know? I actually want them to find happiness, but how you kind of navigate the waters, especially in this landscape of consent and all these kind of things. I mean, is that something you've had to deal with very much? I mean, you don't need to say anything private about your son, but more just sort of broadly about how it should be approached, I guess. How do we talk to our kids about things like that?
Yeah, so I do get queries from parents. Like, there was this parent who had a 20-year-old son, and he said, "I discovered a packet of condom in my son's bag. Should I be concerned?" That was his question. And I said that you should not be, because he's at an age. He's a major. He is already 20. And first of all, that kind of, because, you know, as parents, we are used to see our kids as kids.
Yeah.
We never see them as growing adults.
Yeah.
So firstly, kind of reassuring him that his son is an adult.
Yeah.
Technically, legally, he's an adult. So he can make decisions, and this is very obvious. So he was like, "Oh my God, yeah, that is something which is normal." It's normal to see that. And secondly, I say that, you know, you should be happy that he's practicing safe sex. He knows that. He's going to be sexually safe and healthy. So also showing that condom is not necessarily as something which is a red flag, but it's showing that he's responsible towards sexual activity. He's keeping himself safe. Because, you know, it's so intimidating for, especially in a relationship like parent and kid, because they think, okay, because we are raised by a generation, our parents never talked about it with us. And we have no framework of how we can talk about it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we did not have internet and smartphones, and our kids have internet and smartphones. So we need to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, how do you navigate that? If my 12-year-old saw something online, how should I talk to him about that?
So first thing, I always tell them that, you know, normalize bodies, including private parts of the body or the private body. You know, for me, I make sure that my son knows the correct name of all his body parts, including the penis. Like, for my mother, it was so difficult, because whenever she was dressing him up, she would say PV or, you know, chichu. I don't know what euphemism they use for. And I said, "No, it's penis." And she was totally shocked that, okay, how can I say this word? Even as parents, like, we create that difference that something between your legs, it is, you know, it is invisible. That thing between your legs. Even I see people saying that thing or this, they always address it by that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that thing is something. So I say it's not this or that. It's either sex, penis or vulva.
Mm-hmm.
So just to normalize these words as any other words. Now, of course, I'm also talking about boundaries. I'm not saying that, okay, you go ahead and you talk about it. There are boundaries. But your kids should be aware about the body parts, first of all. Secondly, kids really react incredibly, like respond incredibly to their parents' stories. As parents, we had our own journeys of, you know, crushes. We had been through puberty. I had my own breast development or menstruation or crushes. I mean, even my father had back in his age where he went through a puberty, or he might have seen cinema, especially today's parents. So why not talk about, or why not share those stories as how it was for you growing up, the confusion you had, the questions you had, but you couldn't ask. Your kid very well will be having same questions or even more than that.
Yeah.
So talk about your own stories with your kids, so that they know that you are a human being, you are not on a pedestal. Like, you know, a lot of times we put parents on the pedestal as they are these higher beings and they are supposed to know it all and are all sorted and all perfect. I mean, parents are as imperfect. Parents are also learning every day. For me, my struggle as a single mother is, which is every day. And sometimes I do tell my son, like, he asked me that, okay, you know, why you and dad are not living together? And I said that sometimes we go on our own ways, and it's fine for people to go on their own ways, but it doesn't make them any less of a person. To normalize this, because, you know, sometimes we just paint this idealistic picture of relationship in front of the kids, which they find it so hard to live in themselves. Because we are ourselves, like, I get stories from couple. I was counseling this couple today, and he said, "We don't want our kids to know what is happening between us." And I said, "Your kids will anyway come to know about it. It's better that, you know, you don't keep it." I'm not saying that you need to fight like cats and dogs, but make that imperfection is not necessarily a flaw or a failure. It's something as just human.
Mm-hmm.
So be relatable, be approachable. For me, when I was a kid, I would always look my parents as somewhere which is a higher authority. Now for me, my kid knows that he's an equal in the family. He knows an equal. I'm not pretending to be someone, you know, who has done it all. And I try to be fair. Like he was just, he was touching himself. Like, you know, say, I don't call it as a masturbation. It's like being curious. Kids are curious about their bodies.
Yeah.
Now, I know parents who yell at their kids and who say, what are you doing? Like, you know, like really scream, what are you doing? If they found their kids touching their genitalia. So you are actually creating that fear in the kid's mind, and you are also creating a curiosity, because he's going to do or she's going to do what you're stopping him to do. You cannot stop him. You cannot say you can't do it. You need to make them aware that, okay, there are boundaries. So I tell, okay, you go and you have this room and you want to touch yourself, you go. But it's not wrong. If I say you can't do it, he has all the more reasons to be intrigued about it, and he will go on internet or he will go to his friends.
Yeah.
So to not create that embargo around sexuality, know that your kid is growing up in a world which is filled with images, sexually explicit images. We are showing kids, we are taking our kids to movies where the actor and the actress are kissing. They are like, you know, it's a lip lock.
Yeah.
And then we assume, or we expect our kids not to think about it, how it is possible.
Yeah, no, it's so true. It's so true. And I think that's a brilliant idea of giving it the boundaries. And I totally agree with you about no shame and making them very familiar with their body, but also aware that there's things that they, if they want to do that, give them the space to do it, but also maybe introducing the idea that it's a private thing. Because actually doing it gently like that means that they'll never have that awkwardness. And as you say, they're still going to do it, but they'll just maybe find it a bit shameful or not want to talk to you about it. Plus, I guess there's a whole, as they get older, we're only the parents, you know, you want them to feel like they can find the right person in their life that will give them the advice, even if it's not us, you know, we don't have to be the people they go to for everything. But I suppose I do get a bit worried about the online stuff sometimes, because I don't think kids are looking for it. But I think when they're little, if they come into contact with something and see something that's quite confusing and an unusual. I remember years ago, my 12-year-old, when he was probably about 8 or 9, and he had searched up with a friend. I think he searched something silly like hot girl boobs and just seen loads and loads of pictures of women's boobs, women's breasts. And I had to do this really delicate chat about how just because you could look it up didn't mean you were allowed to see everybody's, and that not every woman that he knew would have somewhere a picture of their breasts on the internet. And it was like, you know, it's probably a lot of information for him, but, you know, it's a hard one, isn't it? I mean, I know I've spoken a lot about consent. It's probably just because as the mother of sons, I feel like it's something that's I feel quite a lot of responsibility in making sure that the right side of the tracks were there. So I get the impression from what you're doing that you're really quite ambitious. And actually, if you've only been doing what you do out, as you say, since 2018, you've already achieved so much. What are your hopes for the future? Do you have a kind of idea of what you want to do?
Yeah, so certainly I am. I'm also running, you know, it as an organization. So I really want this legacy. I feel that there is this legacy I'm trying to create, and I want it to be there and have more and more people join this and be like, you know, like sex education as a profession is still not something that youngsters are looking up to. So I want to really encourage and motivate more and more young people to become sexuality educators, because there is a dire need. So that is one thing, is I really want people to be inspired and understand the necessity and, you know, importance of this profession. Also I'm launching courses on intimacy, where there will be courses on self-pleasuring, or the courses on, you know, how to get over a sexless marriage, or fantasies, how to fantasize. This is the course I'm actually working on, you know, in recent days. So I'm very optimistic about these courses, as these would be like scientifically accurate. At the same time, this is more personalized and keeping that fine balance between, you know, sensuality, like really being sensual but not being obscene.
obviously for you, it's you'll be thinking a lot about India, the place where you grew up and the culture you grew up in, and how mm-hmm. much room that has to grow. But do you think, when you look around, do you feel like everywhere's got room to evolve when it comes to the way they talk about sex?
Yes, I tell you. So I can actually... So I was in touch with this, she's a tantra coach. So tantra is also a discipline of sexuality, Eastern discipline, where there's a lot of mergence between tantra and sexuality. So she's a tantra coach, and she's a European, and she's from Netherlands, and she's a single mother, and her kids are like 15 and 16. So we were collaborating for a talk, which was basically, masturbation. It was basically a facilitated masturbation experiences, camera off. So that was a very, way ahead of its times kind of a workshop that we did.
So you were actually doing a workshop with people masturbating with the camera off.
Yes. Wow. So that was her brainchild, and she got me as a facilitator, where I would guide them in with the music and instructions and, creating that mood. So it was like there was no nudity, because for them the cameras was off, I was clothed. And during the preparation of a talk, I just asked her that, how is it in your country? You are from Europe. So she said, Pallavi, it's better than India, but I'm a sexuality coach or an educator. And when my kids went to school, so their peers, the students said that, your mother is a prostitute.
Oh, okay. That's helpful. Wow.
Yes.
That's funny, because you think about somewhere like the Netherlands as being really... I mean, the perception from where I'm sitting is that they'd be really quite relaxed, actually, about all the nuances within that world, but obviously not. But I suppose as well for kids, it's an easy way to, using wrong terminology is a very easy way to get a rise out of people as well. And I suppose there's just a lot of discomfort, and in a lot of people, it's what you go home to, how your parents have raised you, how they talk about sex. These all factor into, if you've been encouraged to feel shameful about it at home, you might want to push that shame out there too, because it's quite threatening maybe when your peers actually are pretty relaxed and they grow up in a home where it's more relaxed. I don't know, but that's really I was quite surprising that. I mean, is it something that your son, I know that my 9-year-old is quite, he's sort of semi-interested in what I get up to for a living, not massively. Mm-hmm. Is it something that your son talks to you about?
Okay, my son? So, yes, because, he has heard this word so many times, like sexuality or sex. So he definitely, he did ask me, and sometimes he even used this word like, okay, I know you must be talking something about sex. And I was like very jolted, like, what are you saying? But then I realized, okay, if I'm trying to normalize the word, I should be prepared. I should not be intimidated when I'm hearing it from my own son, because it was a curiosity. So right now he's not really asked me the question, but I do talk about like when it comes to touching the body. So I say it's a body education, like, if he really, because as I said, it's age appropriate, and you can choose to be, you can choose your words in a way that these are not ambiguous or these are not bogus, like saying that, what you're doing, your mother is a body educator, she helps people understand their bodies. So that's something I have thought of. In fact, even I found him watching some pictures that just popped up on his screen when he was surfing YouTube. And his friends told me that, he was watching something, wedding picture. So they said it's a wedding picture with a man and a woman. And that's their interpretation. So I told him that, see, this is not for your age. This, you understand driving. You can't drive. He said, yeah, I can't drive because you don't have a license. You need to be 18. Mm-hmm. So similarly, in the similar fashion, there are many things that is not, this is not at for at this age, but this is for adults. So, finding the right way to speak, like tomorrow if he asks me that, okay, mom, what do you do? So if he's like right now, he's 9 and say 10 and 11. So I will say sexuality is something that, it's two adults connect with each other on a personal, private, intimate level. That's the kind of language I will create without feeling ashamed or embarrassed.
Yeah. Now that sounds like a really sensible way to deal with it. And I like the idea of saying some things are meant for adults, because actually sometimes when we have all the context for what they're seeing, but they don't. They just know they've walked into, it's like walking into the wrong room, isn't it? Like, oh, I'm not supposed to be in here. Shut that door. And then if they do have anything that confuses them or, you know, they're curious about, they can always ask you. But sometimes we kind of, we fill in a lot of gaps that maybe they're not actually thinking about right now. And I suppose when you sort of look back at your, you know, everything that's happened, does it, do you feel like really, I don't know, impressed with how your sort of bravery and your strength of how you've been able to move your life on?
That is such a profound question. I'm so glad that, you know, in this moment itself, I just reflected back onto my journey. So I really feel that I was God's chosen child, like, you know, to really come onto this, because there have been so many sexless marriages. And what happened with me was not something I would say were very unique to me, but I think, you know, I was just destined. I believe in the universal energy. I don't believe in the, you know, the symbolic figures of, you know, the gods and the goddesses, but I do believe in that goodness and energy and the universe, the universal principles. So I feel that, okay, I was just destined to do, and I'm very glad that I was chosen for this, and I chose to do this. I'm very glad, because, and every day I tell you, even with certain setbacks like this, you know, Instagram block or something, when people reach out to me and they say that, you know, they really take value and my posts are blessing for them, or we learn so much from your post, I think that's the kind of validation for my work. Is it so important? Yeah.
And no, I can really get a sense of that. I mean, I think that that's an amazing feeling, actually, to kind of be able to feel like you could be the voice for all the people who aren't feeling comfortable about speaking out. And that means that it never feels like work. It's more like you're quite sort of driven. It gives you a daily momentum for setting up your stall and thinking, you know, I want to reach everybody and make sure they feel they can explore all that and have those conversations. Do you sometimes have it as well with your friends, where they kind of come to you and they say, like, you've actually really helped me? I bet you do.
Yeah, yes, it does happen. When they say, like, even in my sessions, when they say that, you know, it has really helped me. And I mean, I always tell them that, you know, it's not just about fixing a problem, but it's also about enhancing the quality of your relationship. So see from that perspective. And thankfully, now people are thinking from that direction, that, you know, seeking out couple coaching, or even say from a therapist, couple therapist, it's not a matter of shame or to say that something is wrong, but it's about, you know, I have this luxury relationship. Like, I always give this analogy that, you know, if you have a luxury car, if you have a Mercedes, so you would not try to fix it yourself. You will go to an expert to fix the Mercedes. So your marriage is your Mercedes. You need to go to an expert. Yeah.
Well, I guess also when you've spoken a lot about, you know, about your mind and your body, and how you say your body, you know, you're helping people educate about their body. I think sometimes we still can divorce our mindset from our bodies, you know, and there's a lot of times where your body is just the thing getting your head where it needs to be, and your head and how you're feeling is not connected to how you're feeling about, you know, in your skin. So yes. I think that holistic approach of just actually seeing the full spectrum of yourself is so important for leading a more fulfilled, open, happy life, and supporting other people do the same.
Yes.
Good for that. All right, well, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to let you get off to your... Are you doing anything nice this evening? What's happening in Delhi tonight? Or are you staying in?
Oh, I will just go for a walk, and I will see what my kid is doing in the other room. You know, it seems like I've just locked the door. So I told him that, okay, don't come for an hour.
Oh, so. Okay. Well, tell him thank you from me. Tell him thank you for letting me have his mum for a while. Mm-hmm. It's been so nice to talk to you.
Sophie.
I'll be pointing your new people in your direction, your new shiny new Instagram.
Thank you, cool. Sophie. I look forward
to it. Lots of love. So do you see what I mean there with the themes and about how significant it is to have a little pause and think if you're really being very true to yourself in terms of your ability to articulate your emotional and physical needs, desires, thoughts, and if they're being heard and if you're happy. And I know it's a work in progress, but I suppose the most important thing is a willingness to sort of give that space and room and make sure that you're actually checking in with yourself about those things, and you know where to turn and who to talk to if you need to. It's such an important thing. You don't win any prizes for
for pretending you're into stuff you're not, you know. As if you needed telling. I'm sure you don't need telling that. But I thought it was really lovely to speak to Pallavi, and I'm so impressed with her. I think it's an exceptionally type, you know, exceptional type of bravery to grow up with one set of values and then be able to articulate that you don't actually, you want to push through taboos. Sorry, I am really woolly in the head today. You can probably tell I'm struggling to articulate myself. I've been up most of the night with a very hot two-year-old. He was not feeling very well. And that is on top of not really sleeping very well all week. So that's been great. Although we did manage, once the kids were in bed, we watched Candyman last night. Have you seen it? It's good, actually. I do like a horror. I mean, it's a bit spoofy in parts, but I did quite enjoy it. Although it's weird. I love horror films. I love being scared. But then when the anticipation is building, I'm most likely to put my fingers in my ears and sort of hide 90% of what I can actually see on the screen. So I sort of like them the most in retrospect. I don't know what that says about me. But if you go through my top 10 films, I think probably 70% of them are scary films. This week, what have I got coming up? Oh, so I've recorded another few podcasts for you, and I've got a couple of lovely ones that I'm about to release and publish that I think you'll really enjoy. And next week's one is pretty zhuzhy, actually. I love that word. I've never known how to spell it, but I like saying it. And I'm also recording a couple this week of really amazing people too. So lots of treats in store. Would you believe I'm approaching my 50th guest? That's actually pretty loopy. That's a lot of conversations. That's a lot of chat. And that's a lot of people being completely brilliant guests and talking about lots of things. Just to me, how nice. And then I can share it with you. But I hope you're going to have a lovely week. I'm off to Ireland tomorrow, actually, for a bit of work. And then in and around, it's quite a nice week this week. I've got lots of different things on the go. Lots of different areas of my work that are being stimulated this week. Areas of my work are being stimulated, which is probably taking on from, I don't know, Pallavi and the conversation she has about what's being stimulated. No, there's a thread there somewhere. But quite frankly, I don't really want to go into detail about what my brain was trying to do with that. Don't think it quite worked. That's annoying. Anyway, I'm going to go back and see if Mickey's feeling any better. I think it's probably time for me to go and have a really large coffee just to try and kickstart the cogs in my brain. Because I feel like you can hear them turning very, very slowly. It's not a good way to be, particularly if you're trying to talk to someone and record yourself speaking to someone and you're hoping that they enjoy what you're saying. So on that wonderful note, I'm going to bid you adieu. Have a lovely week, and I'll see you next time. And thank you as ever for lending me your ears. And I hope all is good with you. Lots and lots of love. See you soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.